It's 1 o'clock. We're going to call the property tax and local sales tax division to order. And our first bill, we do not have a quorum yet, but when we do, the motion that we're going to make on House File 635 from Representative Hosh is that it be motion to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. And so this will not be going into the division report, but it will be traveling on its own little merry way. So, Representative Hosh, if you would please proceed on House File 635.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The House File 635, I think, is rather simple. It deals with Green Acres, and I don't think we need to have a educational session on what Green Acres is this year. It simply delays the implementation by 1 year. This would, I believe, allow the legislature to address some of the policy issues with the recently passed Green Acres legislation, while at the same time give some comfort to our farmers, especially for this season coming up before us rather shortly with planting and harvest. So I would encourage the committee support.
Very good. Do you have testifiers today here, Representative Hosh? Is there, before we go to members' questions, maybe go to testifiers, and I very much appreciate you bringing this bill forward. So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I do not have any specific testifiers due to the fact that I think this has been aired quite extensively in different committees, and also looking at the agenda for the committee due to time constraints, not that we could just address this on its merits. So.
Very good. Is there anyone here that would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Kip Meyer, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
My name is Mary Kip Meyer, State Representative 16B in Sherburne County. And certainly I appreciate the effort and the issues that we're dealing with here in Green Acres, but as I've listened here, and I think of my farmers back home, I think I can hear them saying right now that this will not be very comforting to them. They will probably proceed to do some of the same things I talked about because they see a delay as only shortening their opportunity to take care of their own land. And I suspect that they would probably be likely to continue with the things that I think are an unintended bad consequence, which is doing things with their land, such as cutting the windrows. A delay of 1 year, to them, they will say, it's still going to happen, so we're still going to keep doing what we need to do, which is to convert our land to productive land, which means changing of the uses of their properties, whether it's trees or other things as well. So I don't think that it's going to, the farmers are going to agree with this 1 year deferral, though I think it is well intended. I appreciate the effort, but I don't know that I'll have the intended result.
Well, thank you, Representative. I'm a bit perplexed because I've heard on the House floor for the last couple months that we've got to do something now because people are going to start killing in April and so forth. And I mean, this timing was a huge, huge thing that I've heard time and time again. And now you're saying this a year wouldn't make a difference to put things off a year so that things can really be debated if and when changes are made? You don't think this would do any good at all?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I think it's, like I said, I think it's intention as well, but I think to those regular farmers out there, when I look at the deadline here of December, of notice of intent and some of the consequences go with that, I'm just saying that I don't know that they would concur with the intention. And when we spoke on the House floor, it was to a bill that would have just repealed it all. And from what I heard from the folks in my district, that a complete repeal and doing that right away would have a substantial beneficial effect to their decision making.
I appreciate that. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have to respectfully disagree. I believe we have 19 separate Green Acres bills moving through the process. I'm an author of one of those, and we have had hearings in the Agriculture Committee. We have had bills passed the Agriculture Committee. One of the things that we have to respect within the legislature is the institutions of the House and the Senate. And, I am most interested in doing what we can in the most rapid fashion. I believe the bill before us is the easiest and most succinct way to do that. The authors of this bill include the Speaker of the House, the Chair of the Tax Committee, and many, many others. I believe we can get this through rather quickly, while at the same time allowing the legislative process to continue with the other Green Acres bills, and we can have a comprehensive reform that is going to address the concerns of Representative Chipmeyer's constituents and farmers along with mine. And I think I'm rather confident and hopeful that we'll be able to do that with another Green Acres bill later this year. But right now, let's do what we can within the political confines that we have. And I think this bill, with a one-year delay, is the best approach to do it. So I would encourage the support of the committee.
Any other questions for the testifier? Otherwise, thank you. Anyone else care to testify for or against? Please come forward. And we do now have a quorum. So, Representative Conan, would you move for House File 635 to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Tax?
So moved.
All right, thank you. Please proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Kuha. I'm Cass County Assessor. I'm also the chair of our Legislative Committee of the state organization known as Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill and support it. And I think there's a variety of reasons why giving additional time would be of benefit, especially to the farmers who may be involved in having to make a decision regarding the withdrawal of the non-productive acres. The payback in some cases reaches into the thousands of dollars, and there are serious consequences that the farmers have to consider when they're moving forward with this particular program. So we are here speaking in favor of the one-year extension for the withdrawal issue here.
Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Kuha, you are here, and I've got a question for the assessor. There's a lot of the confusion is with people killing up wind shelters and land, like, that type of thing, wind belts, and yet the statute says that Class 2A property, which is agricultural, may contain property that would otherwise be classified as 2B, which we were taking out of Green Acres, but could otherwise be classified as 2B, including but not limited to smooth, wooded wind shelters, acreage abutting ditches, and other similar land impractical for the assessor to value separately from the rest of the property. And yet, as I was reading stories last summer and so forth, there was a disconnect here with this part of the law, because folks were doing this and saying they had to do this, and they said, well, it's part of my agricultural unit. Your comments on that, because that seemed to be a real source of contention on all this, and it looks like it's very clear here in state law that the assessors have the right to take that into consideration, that property that would otherwise be classified as B2B could be classified as 2A.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of overreaction, I believe, in some people's minds regarding especially the windrows, the sloughs, the wetlands, the rock piles. I don't know of any assessor who is not treating that those particular pieces of the farm property as 2A. There isn't a need, I don't believe, for landowners to start having to cut down their wind protection, wind shelter belts, in order to put it into cultivated land to get it into the 2A class. That's not what assessors are doing out there. Although, you're right, there's a lot of alarm and there's a lot of concern that is going to happen, and landowners are fearful of that, so there's a lot of kind of war stories being told about what they're having to do or what they think they have to do. But I think that's an overreaction. It shouldn't be a major concern.
I think it's important for legislators, if you have farmers about to do these type of things, to check into the statute to see what's actually there, and also check with the assessor. Because to me, much of what I've heard is allowed, would be allowed in Green Acres, according to this portion of the statute. And I know there was some real mixed signals going out there that I think had a lot, and I appreciate your comments, because I think it was some over alarm. And I also have to say, in last year's tax bill that tends to get forgotten, is that one of the reasons we separated or created a rural vacant land was to lower ag land value. Because what was happening in a lot of cases, people would come in, buy this land for hunting, would drive up this ag land, and then all the ag land would kind of be put into one big bucket, I guess, and raise everyone. By separating that, you could keep ag land, and recreational land, and it was to help that. But also another portion that helped farmers in that bill was that the first tier of ag homestead, that classification rate was lowered from 0.55 down to 0.50, which was about a 9% cut in ag land up to your first 890,000 valuation, which this year is going to go over $1 million. So I think that gets lost as some folks talk about what happened here. The intent on Green Acres was not to take a program away, but to actually try to make it work better for those who were using it, try to allow those who couldn't get into it, because some counties weren't doing it, to get into it, and then also to do away with some of the abuses to lower property taxes on others. The tax bill was, you know, an attempt in many ways to help lower property taxes for everyone, including farmers on this. But any questions for Mr. Kuha? So I really appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Anyone else for or against this House File 635? And Madam Chair, this is going to your committee. We got that right, I think so. We got Representative Winteski.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Representative Posh for bringing this forward, and I think your comments, Mr. Chair, are accurate. It's collective memory, I think, on the part of the folks in the legislature who may not have cracked this issue, and I do think the way to think about all this is if some of the changes for ag lands were not done right, then we need to reconsider everything, and that includes what you just stated, the fact that the first tier of ag homestead was reduced, a significant property tax. These were meant to happen all together for farmers, and if, you know, now people are going to say that none of these, all the Green Acres changes were wrong, we're going to have to go back, and that's how an omnibus tax bill works, and look at all the moving pieces, because we delivered significant property tax relief to farmers in the omnibus tax bill. And I'll remind for members of this committee who know that they are currently paying the lowest effective tax rates in the state compared to any other kind of property that there is. But I think Representative Hosh and I, who have disagreed on kind of what should have happened in Green Acres, he's trying to respond to the cries of that we've just heard from the assessor. Many are, you know, are unfounded, that all these actions are going to take place, and they're going to take place in April and May. And I think this bill addresses the concern that people have that, you know, we can't wait till the omnibus tax bill comes out. And I think we've all heard that bipartisanly. The House has voted on this issue already. The committee of the whole, 134 members, have taken a vote on full repeal this year, twice. And it has failed, twice. So I think just the political reality for folks who think that the repeal is going to leave the House anytime soon is the Minnesota House has taken that vote already twice this year. So there's no election between now and 2 years from now. It's the same governor, same legislators. I think Representative Haas has done something very clever here, which is to say, okay, I can read the tea leaves. The Minnesota House is not repealing this before May. But I want to send notice to everybody out there that we'll give another year for people to think this through. And I think it's a creative middle ground solution. You know, I would just add, I sure hope that we're going to have a full omnibus tax bill signed and by May 18th. I think there's a lot of people who think that might not happen. So I guess I would just respectfully disagree with Representative Kiffmeyer, who testified that, you know, I think not doing this actually means the likelihood of sticking with last year's tax bill is very high for a very long time. I hope I'm wrong, but I think it's going to be really rough to get everything done in a real timely way. And I just hope that's not true. But this gives assurance that whether we're done on May 18th or not, everyone gets another year. And so I guess I would look at it as a creative solution to get around difficult people like me, and I admit that I'm one of those people. But I think to say, you know, folks are waiting and folks are fearful and all this change is going on and what are you going to do, it sort of frames the debate as the options are repeal or nothing. And those aren't the options. And we've already voted on repeal twice this year. The full body has already done that twice this year. And both times it failed. So, you know, I guess I'm just sort of struggling as to why, you know, if I guess I would be concerned if the folks affected by last year opposed the hospital. That would tell me we're kind of okay with what we did last year, because I think to think we're going to go back in time and do a full repeal without removing all these other provisions seems pretty small. And I think, you know, the fact that the governor, for example, has released his budget and has not changed Green Acres and it's passed how it was a couple times earlier this year, I think people have to be realistic about the alternatives are probably time to make things better for errors that may have happened that people disagree with, and leaving it how it is. And I think Representative Haas is saying, well, let's have everyone not dig up the wetlands, tear down the, cut down the trees, and give them another year so we can judiciously, thoughtfully work through a process, which I think you said there's 19 CFOP-authored bills already in the process that are going through. So I'm honestly perplexed how anyone would oppose this, but thank you.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand what you're trying to do here, Representative Posh, and I understand your logic, Madam Chair, here, but you know, all this does is delays any solution. And think about it from the standpoint of a landowner right now who's facing huge property tax increases as a result of the law change. If we do this, if we pass this, the uncertainty for what's going to happen down the road is still there. We haven't taken it away. It seems to me that we ought to take the uncertainty away and do what we're supposed to do, repeal this law, work on it, try to come up with a better fix. I understand what you're trying to do here, but this still breeds all kinds of uncertainty on the part of landowners who still are going to wonder what's the legislature going to do next year.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lanning. The uncertainty with doing nothing is much greater, and I think this approach is one that I hope and am optimistic that we can pass rather quickly and provide some certainty at least through the next year. Look, being on the A committee myself and seeing the testimony and the many bills that came before us, I'm also certain that we're going to continue to address this issue in a larger policy perspective. And I hope to see another Green Acres bill that's going to be much more conducive to our constituents. But seeing what's happened in the Senate and in the House, I would like to try this approach. And I think this provides much more certainty over the current situation we're in.
Representative
Lanny. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I understand your logic here, but we had a chance as a legislature to fix this problem in the short term, to remove the uncertainty, just repeal the law, go to work on it. The Green Acres law that we passed last year, we found out, much to the surprise of all of us who were involved in some way, that it didn't do exactly what we had hoped it would do. And let's throw it out, let's repeal it as was proposed to do and was turned down, and go to work on trying to fix something so people know down the road what's going to happen. All we're doing here is extending the uncertainty. And if I owned a piece of land that was in Green Acres, if this is passing, I still wonder what the heck's going to happen a year from now, if anything.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I think we're just looking at just delaying, putting some time frame on it, to just delaying what the original Green Acres bill is all about. And again, talking to my constituents, the best thing would be to do the repeal. I know we voted on it twice in the House, and I hope we have more chances to do it in the future. And start and put together a grid. We need to make changes in the Green Acres law, and we all agree there, but we need to do it in committee and work on it from there.
Representative Mowry.
Well, Mr. Chair, and with all due respect to some of the members of the committee and one of the testifiers, the fact is, the certainty is that we're going to change Green Acres. And to say we'll repeal this law and everybody's going to be happy, that's not telling anybody anything, because they don't know what we're going to do in the future. We don't know. But I think there's probably nobody here that has any idea that it's not going to be changed from the present law. So the argument that there's more certainty by repealing this is just completely failed.
Any other comments? Anyone else that would care to testify for or against House File 635? Representative Scott?
Just a real short question. Why do we need to delay it? Why do we need this? Why don't we just move forward? Why delay it a year? I don't see what good that does.
Representative Hahn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, as I stated before, a repeal bill has been going through the process, has passed the 8th Finance Committee. On the floor, however, both in the House and the Senate, it failed. And for my constituents, I have 2,800 properties that are enrolled in Green Acres. My duty to them is to represent their desire for a change, but also to work within the confines that the legislature presents itself. I hope we can pass this bill, and I have a list of every single one of my Green Acres property owners, and if there's some level of uncertainty, I'm going to communicate with them that this is the best option that we have before us to do something quickly, while still continue to pursue changes in the Green Acres laws, and they'll be getting that communication from me. So I will be working with my constituents to try to reduce some of the uncertainty in front of them, but also work within the confines of this legislature, not only in the House, but also in the Senate. And I think that this is an option that we can do to pass rather quickly and set some minds at ease.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Hodge, I can't really disagree with your intent of it, and especially, the Chair brought up the fact that we've had two votes on the House floor. But just something for us to consider is that different people vote for or against amendments for different reasons, right? And I think there's quite a few members who probably voted against it because, out of respect to the chair of the Agriculture Committee or the chair of the Tax Committee, they wanted to see legislation move through the process. And it seems like someone who agrees with you on this issue, you and I are on the same boat, we're kind of negotiating against ourselves here by putting this out there. I mean, this maybe, closer towards the end of session, this is the compromise position, but it would be nice if we kept the pressure up to get those bills to move through the process and come up for a vote. Now, as far as I know, I don't think the repealers have been killed in any committee. Does anyone know any of the bills that would... I don't think any committee has actually taken an up or down vote on it. And, the Chair of the Tax Committee is absolutely correct that on the House floor there's been, I think one of them was a germaneness vote. I think the other one was actual the repeal. That a lot of times members of the majority will do that out of respect for the committee chairs. And so I would hope that regardless, of how people feel about this bill, that us passing this, my vote in favor of this today in no way, shape, or form undercuts my support for the full repeal, and that we're going to continue to push for that through the committee process. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Haas, you said you have 2,800 Green Acre constituents?
Properties,
okay. If they were to give you a vote, whether they want to repeal or your bill, what do you think?
Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, they would want me to do what could be done in as quick of a possible time within the confines that we had. They would much rather have me pass a delay than fight for a repeal that doesn't have a political ability to move forward in the process. So they would much rather have this than nothing.
Okay. Anyone else in the audience? Yes. Not. Representative Coonan, the news. His motion to pass House File 635, and we refer this to the Committee on Taxes. We'll take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion carries. So, thank you very much, Representative Hodge, for bringing this forward. Next, we have House File 204. Representative Winkler, thank you for joining us today. If you would present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill has
And hold it just a second. We'll have, would someone like to move this for possible inclusion into the... all right, Representative Mullery moves House File 204 for possible inclusion into the division report. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill has nothing to do with Green Acres. If anything, you would maybe call it Gray Acres. This is for removing a sunset, if you will, on a law that gives cities authority to establish housing improvement areas. Under a prior law, prior to 1996, the legislature had to take action to approve these. In 1996, we granted cities authority to do it, but that grant of authority is set to sunset in 2009. This essentially just removes the sunset and allows cities to continue. Basic info on housing improvement areas, they are established by cities to help condos or townhouse associations make improvements to their property when they don't have a good plan or a good funding source in place to do that. And so what it really does is help to improve and maintain the quality of multi-unit condo type housing in a city, and all of the costs are paid for within the housing improvement area, so that the units that are being receiving the benefit are paying the cost. It's just that the city is stepping in to help finance and make that improvement happen. And with me is a representative from St. Louis Park who will talk briefly about the experience of that city.
Okay, and I think at this time, if it's all right with you, Representative Winkler, if we could have House Research Staff, Karen Baker, talk a little bit about housing improvement areas, because I think this is a new concept for me, and I think probably for most members. So that would be all right before you go in and put it more in context of what you're going to say? Thank you. So, Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we just handed out was a short subject which I did with Deb Dyson a couple years ago on housing improvement areas. And I'll just make a few comments about it. And housing improvement area is a defined area that's in a city where housing improvements in condos and townhouse complexes can be financed with assistance of the city or with EDA or an HRA. The improvements that are made under this law are improvements that are made to the actual buildings or to the complex itself, including things like roofing and siding and landscaping, roadways, walkways. These housing improvement areas can only be established if 25% of the owners of the units in that proposed area actually file a petition, and then the city pursues that and prepares an ordinance that describes the area and states the basis for imposing the fees and makes a finding that without the housing improvement area, these improvements couldn't be made. And then it goes through a notice and public hearing and ordinance, and the city finances these with dollars, and which oftentimes is bonding, and then it's paid for by the people that own these properties, and it becomes almost like a special assessment. These particular dollar amounts are certified to the county auditor, and the county auditor puts them on the property tax statement, and it shows up as a special assessment. One of the things with these housing improvement areas is that although cities are supposed to report to the Commissioner of Revenue when they've established one of these, and I think the law actually says they have to do it within like 30 days of establishing, that has never been done. And so consequently, we really don't have any idea how many housing improvement areas there really are. When Deb Dyson and I did this particular short subject, we did a lot of calling around to see what we could find that was out there, and you can see on the second page of that short subject that it lists the ones that we were able to find at that time, and that's a couple years ago. Coon Rapids and Hopkins both having four, and New Hope, Plymouth, St. Louis, and Victoria.
So there really isn't any other way that we know of to actually see that these exist, because when the county auditors receive these dollars from the city, or I should say these listings from the city, it's listed as a special assessment or not identified, and so counties really don't have any way of knowing this. With that, I guess I'll end, and if there's any questions, and I'm sure the testifiers can answer probably more than I can. But
thank you very much, Ms. Baker. Questions on this? Representative Mulley and what Ms. Baker had to say.
Chair and Ms. Baker, I was just wondering, since these are, the common areas are actually owned by the owners of the townhouse or condominium, do we have examples of where a city can do this for single family or duplexes or whatever? Can they loan the money to do a roofing or whatever, siding, landscaping? Can they do that? Is that legal to do for other than certain types of housing, such as condos and townhouses?
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulery, I can't think of any right offhand. I don't know if Joel, if he's out there, if he can think of any. Whether or not HRAs and EDAs, if they have any of this power to do through their development and through TIF, I'm not sure if they can.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulery, I think that HRAs have some limited authority to do a special business, small business program that might be similar to the sort of unique circumstance in the federal law, but not federal law, but it's a sort of a target of law that allows the sort of governmental funding for these private, privately owned improvements. And so it's a little bit unusual, but in I believe in the HRA law there's a couple of sort of analogous things that probably aren't very widely used either.
Representative Mulery?
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, Mr. Michael, so it could be used for certain types of business, but not for homes or anything like that?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Mulery, I'm not familiar with the instance where standalone, these are homes because they're typically townhouses, and small-based development, so they are homes. But if you're thinking about just standalone, single dwelling,
I'm not aware of. Now, the NRP program might have
that
kind of
element to it. Another example, but I'm not aware of a general law authority
on
like this.
Representative
Walker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Baker, it seems to me that this might leave the local government more at risk in these particularly uncertain housing times when you have so many properties going into tax forfeiture or foreclosure, and particularly when I know I see from the news that there's lots of these sorts of developments that have been overbuilt given the market. They were in the works already, and I'm wondering if I'm correct in assuming that if the property does go tax forfeited, if the municipality is left holding the bag for making up these fees that would typically be covered through the association of the condo or townhouse, and that this would really be perhaps one of the reasons why we asked for reporting that hasn't occurred.
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lawler, I would think that that would be somewhat of a concern, because if in fact these properties do go forfeit, and even if liens are put on, like special assessments, that if the property is sold, then when it is sold, the dollars of the special assessments are one of the things that get paid back first, the taxes and specials. But in the meantime, when all of this is going on, these really have to be paid. And so I would think that organizations or these associations would probably meet and say, we have to pay that amount, whether it's an escrow or whatever, because we don't want to start defaulting on this. So I'm not exactly sure if it would be the owners or the city that would, I would think that they would get together and decide who really should pay that. And it could be the city, and it also could be that the other property owners may also have some real concerns and obligations.
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, perhaps our testifiers and witnesses can address the issue of, it feels to me like there was a sunset put on this because this was a broad authority and just to see what happened. And I think we need to understand why there hasn't been the reporting, because I'm thinking of other home improvement community redevelopment initiatives that are available as tools to cities. They tend to be structured in a very different way, and I don't know why this particular ownership model could have a unique form of financing that doesn't have those same sort of, you know, more broad and more targeted, more broadly accountable, I mean, less risk to the local taxpayer, but also targeted at who receives this. I mean, this is for an entire condominium, and I assume that the main reason for doing this is that that the bonds would be at a lower interest rate than the condominium or townhouse association could get on their own. But I'm wondering whether or not the city could do it through their other redevelopment tools rather than through this kind of a mechanism.
Ms. Baker, I think wanted to answer part of this for some clarity.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, you know, one of the things is prior to 96, special legislation was needed for each individual one that came in. And then the law was changed so that we would have a general law that had a window there to let them come in just under general law and establish them. I think the hope was, with those few year kind of window, is that the legislature would know how many were out there, get a feeling for what they were being used for and how they were working. And yet, to the best of my knowledge, and we can ask the Department of Revenue, but I don't think that any of these are being reported, and so I don't think we have any better handle now than we did back in, you know, 96 of what's going on. And I think that's really why that sunset was put on.
Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I think it might be helpful if Ms. Larson from St. Louis Park were to maybe provide a little more of a feet on the ground perspective of how this works. Two quick points I would make. Mr. Michael informs me that the liens for these improvements are ahead of the mortgage because it's a government entity. So they're fairly secure in that sense, that they would be paid before the bank is paid if there's a foreclosure or other instance. And Ms. Larson can add to this, but she tells me that the City of St. Louis Park does, in fact, report to the Commissioner of Revenue. So it might be a question for the Commissioner of Revenue.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kathy Larson. I'm with the City of St. Louis Park, and I'm the Housing Programs Coordinator for the city. While I've been working at the city, we have established four different housing improvement areas in St. Louis Park. The first one was in 2002, and this was the one that was reported to the Department of Commissioner, or the Commissioner of Revenue. The other three have been established since 2006. So we do send in our enabling ordinance to ensure that the commissioner is aware of that. But we would also, you know, look to support a stronger reporting requirement if that would make folks more comfortable with this law. The city is very much in favor of the housing improvement areas. We've established four of them, and I sent around a summary of the four that we've established. The condo associations do have to come to the city, and they do have to request these. In St. Louis Park, our housing stock's a bit older. Most of these were built in the 70s and the 80s, and they have deferred maintenance issues. For the association to make these common improvement areas, make these common improvements, they need an affordable mechanism, and this tool provides that affordable loan for these the owners of these associations. In addition to helping the associations out with these improvements, it also helps the associations get on track for long-term planning. Part of the statute does require that the associations have to establish a long-term finance plan and long-term capital improvement plans. Most of these associations hadn't done that before. And so this tool, as well as providing financing, helps them get on track.
It's been a really grassroots thing in the city. When we had mentioned that 25% of the residents have to petition to ask the city to establish this, so it is grassroots. The city's comfortable doing this because our risk is low. As Representative pointed out, this fee does take first place, so in the event that there is a tax forfeiture or a tax or a foreclosure, those property taxes are first paid. At this point, we have our delinquency rate on the HIAs is consistent with the delinquency rate throughout the whole city, which is less than 1%, and we feel that that's pretty reasonable and pretty low. The other safeguards in place are that when this HIA is established with an association, they're obligated to assign their assets to the city. So in the event someone does not pay, we can go after the association assets and get payment. So the city really feels that this is a very low risk for all of our taxpayers, while just helping out the taxpayers and the residents that really need the help.
Any questions for Larson? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, I'm not familiar with these HIPs, but in order to establish one, does the mortgage company have to be informed of this first, and does consent have to be given to them to establish these?
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, the mortgage company does not have to be notified by the city or the owner. The mortgage company is notified by the county when the taxes are made known to the mortgage companies.
Anyone else? Representative Lanning.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have not been familiar with this tool before, but as I understand it, is this kind of like the property owners being able to petition to improve their property that's privately owned through a form of assessment that where the city is involved? So it's like a special assessment, but it's not on public property, it's on private property. Is that my understanding this correctly?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's it exactly. It's for improving private property. Private property owners pay back on their property taxes. The city lends the money to the association. The owners pay us back.
Chairman, if I might, and there is no blight requirement here like we have with tax increment financing, where you have to show or demonstrate that you've got a blighted property. There's no requirement that that be shown.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, there's no requirement that there needs to be blight as defined by HUD or some other entity. The statute does note that there are certain conditions that do have to take place. Generally, associations don't want to come to us for this because it is somewhat cumbersome compared to if they were able to go out and get private financing. So it isn't a tool that's been sought out by, it's not sought out. I mean, it's not really, it's not the first choice. This is last resort financing, and the statute does state that this is last resort financing. So these associations have to have been turned down by other lenders before they can apply to the city for the HIA designation. Does that address your blight question?
Representative Lanning?
Yes, there's not really a blight requirement, but obviously if they're turned down by mortgage companies or other lenders, they probably have deemed that this is not a good investment.
Ms. Larson, yeah, okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Rep, that's correct.
Representative Lanning?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in this current housing environment that we're in, we're basically asking governments to get involved in making something possible that the private lending community is not willing to take on. Is that correct?
Representative Lanning, are you suggesting this is part of the bailout plan of President Obama?
I don't know.
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, this tool was used prior to the current housing and credit conditions we're experiencing right now. And so it is a tool that's available to condo associations that haven't always been the best fit. You're absolutely right.
Mr. Chair, if I
Representative Winkler
could maybe address a policy direction. It seems like maybe Representative Lanning is kind of heading in here. The context for this, I think if you look at the material from St. Louis Park, the typical value of one of these residences is around $100,000. So at least in the context of St. Louis Park, it's a very affordable housing unit. And a lot of these places are in the category of affordable housing for owner-occupied residences. The city of St. Louis Park historically has maintained very high standards for housing quality, requiring that residences all be brought up to code before they can be sold, for example. And one of the things that has made that city continue to be vibrant is that while the housing is the size of the housing, mm-hmm. houses are tend to be small, they still are attracting new families and growing families all the time because they are of high quality. So this is part of an overall policy direction that the city of St. Louis Park has undertaken for some years to maintain a high level of housing quality in their city as a way to maintain their place as a community of choice in the metro area. So this is why they use it, why it's important, because it helps to maintain that for this type of association, this type of dwelling.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm very supportive of efforts to try and the tools necessary to make housing more affordable, and so now I have a better understanding of what you're trying to do here. What I'm still bothered with here is that we really don't know how well these have been working in the last 10 years. And we don't have any kind of report or analysis. We don't know to what extent there have been any problems with any of these districts that have been set up. And frankly, I'm a little troubled by that, and I don't know what the solution is, but it's a bothersome concern.
In the Department of Revenue, I mean, if they're supposed to get reports, is there, Mr. Nord, is there any light you can shed on Representative Lanning's concerns as far as results on these housing improvement areas, Mr. Nord?
Mr. Chair, it turns out that we do have a few...
You want to use the mic or the neck, thank you.
It turns out we have received a few of these over time and stuffed them in a file, so we... just called back to the office, and they say there's about 8 or 10 of them in there. So I don't know what information is contained in there, other than there are 8 or 10 different pieces of information about maybe resolutions that have been forwarded to us. But there's no reporting mechanism beyond receiving that resolution or whatever, so we don't really have a meaningful way to track and record the data. And it's very likely that some of these could have been misrouted to tax increment financing district files or been lost along the way. So,
thank you very much. Representative Lanning, did that answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given that response, if we're going to do this, I think we ought to sunset it again, and I think we ought to put some teeth into making sure that we collect the information that we need in order to evaluate this, future legislatures. So, Representative Winkler, I would really encourage you to consider those ideas here if we're going to move forward with it.
Thank you very much. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, just some information. Are we in a situation because the associations haven't been charging enough fees to cover repairs and upkeep of the facilities? Is that the reason why we have this right now? Because they're not collecting the fees they should be collecting?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative. Generally, yes. If the associations had adequate reserves, they wouldn't be looking for a loan to make the improvement. So, unfortunately, most of these associations, when they were established, didn't set up a strong enough fee structure to ensure that they would be collecting reserves or collecting fees that would pay for improvements in the future. So the strength of this bill is that it does require that associations start doing that. And so they do have to put plans into place, both financial and capital improvement plans, to make sure they don't get into this situation again.
Representative
Detmer.
Do we have any statute that regulates these associations and what they need to have on hand to cover expenses for repairs? Is there a statute that says what they need to be? Are they regulated?
Ms. Baker, can you answer that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I can't answer that. I would guess that in the local government committee,
or the housing committee, those kind of questions probably would be better asked, and I could sure check with my colleagues, and you know they could get back with you. But this is kind of a different animal in that although it's like a special assessment, it isn't really a total special assessment, and so it's been dealt with in the tax committee as compared to the local government committee. And if this was in the local government committee, I'm not sure if that question might be able to be answered. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Detmer is...
I'm just curious, you know, I know we only have, I say, eight of these in operation right now, but I'm just curious if there is some state statute that regulates these. So.
I think we're finding out that there's not a lot right now of record keeping.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson might be able to help a little bit.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not familiar with the state statute that does oversee the associations, condo and townhome associations, but I know there is some statutory language that talks about how they have to establish their bylaws and that type of language. But I'm not real familiar with that statute. But I know there is something that the state, you know, the associations do have some reporting required or some connection with state law.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak for or against House File 204? Okay. Seeing none, any other members from the... Representative Mulley, are you renewing your motion to lay this over for possible inclusion in free health file 204? It sounds like we've got some questions here, and I guess I would go with what the members are thinking on this. I mean, can we do this one separately, send it off to local gov, send it to taxes, and maybe go somewhere else? Anyone have any thoughts on this? I mean, I think this bill might need a little more work to give people a little more comfort, and I just don't know for sure what the process might be. Representative Lanning?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would suggest that maybe another appropriate committee or two that needs to look at this concept should be referred to them and then have it come back here for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. It seems to me to be one of the best ways to do it.
Chairman, Representative Mulley. Chairman Chesky, what's your thoughts?
I've found out on Representative Lanning, and you know, this is not Representative Winkler's thing because they're clearly, I think, using it the way that Representative Lanning is. I'm guessing from his comments, the way he's intending. So if it's a statewide issue, I guess one of the concerns I would have, too, is the same thing that Representative Lanning is raising, is we've got a good city with a bunch of good actors trying to do the right thing to keep affordable housing intact and not becoming a blight to the community. And then how do you limit who's going to do this? I mean, you don't want them to have to get blighted. Right? I mean, that's, you know, you don't want to say, look, you have to have a lot of blight, so now you qualify because the goal is here to not have blight. But I think what Representative Lanning is raising is, okay, so is it for everybody with sort of no parameters? And that's not your issue with this bill, but I think it is an issue for the tax committee or the local government committee, and I don't have the answer to that. But I think Representative Lanning's on to something which I think does not affect your personal situation, but just makes everyone kind of think a little harder.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler.
I do think that the point of improving the reporting and making sure that there's some teeth in cities providing the information and the Department of Revenue doing something with it besides putting it in a folder has some merit. And I think if pushing back the sunset as a way to do that and get the reporting. Now, there's no guarantee, Mr. Chair, that any members of the legislature will have any interest in following up on any of those reporting requirements. And so we may come back in 2 years after we've pushed it back and we find out that there's better reporting, but perhaps a different set of legislators around the table still don't really know what these are, and there are a lot of policy questions around them, and think, well, we don't really know much about them, let's learn more over the next 2 years and look at getting rid of that sunset later. I can see that as a potential long-term outcome. So I prefer to try to increase the reporting requirements and do the remove the sunset. But if that's something that's better done in a local government committee, certainly it would be reasonable to send it there. Personally, that this is maybe for Representative Lincheski more than anybody else. There are a number of bills that are coming to the tax committee first to get a hearing and then to be sent around policy committees subsequently and then get back to taxes. And I don't know what the process is for potential inclusion in an omnibus bill, given that there are policy implications here for other committees' jurisdictions.
Yes,
Madam Chair. I don't know the answer to that.
Does anyone know? I mean, I don't know if a division can send a bill to another division. I think it has to all go through the tax committee. So, would people feel comfortable if we sent it, referred to the tax committee, with the idea that it would be sent out to another committee? Chair Lincheski, do you feel comfortable with that or not?
I think you should lay it over and think about it for a while. But I think that about everything. Don't ask me.
I guess,
Mr. Chair,
I mean, one thing that I have some disagreement on a bill, which I don't know if we do, but just to kind of clarify and just there's some real concerns, I don't know if I just want to lay that over. But
Mr. Chair, alternatively, if you send it to the tax committee, I could bring an amendment to the tax committee with plenty of notice and opportunity for anybody who had an opinion to look at that and then consider the amendment in the bill as amended in the tax committee.
Representative Laughlin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would throw one more alternative potentially, which is to turn this into a local bill, since I don't see any other association of cities or others that stepped up to testify.
Well, the League of Cities does have a letter in support of the bill.
Representative.
But to continue, Mr. Chair, though, that the increased reporting to me wouldn't address the issues that have come up, which is this an appropriate tool in the toolbox for local governments to do redevelopment financing? And the issue to me is the policy issue of taking a walk, is a repealer, and just making this open. And I think of in this kind of unsteady housing market, we have to be particularly careful. I think of in downtown Minneapolis when people were investing as speculators, and they put in options to buy buildings before they were even built, and many of them made a lot of money reselling those options on units, and then the music stopped in the market, and some of them got stuck with properties they didn't intend to hold. Their interest as a property owner is to minimize their carrying costs, so they might underpay their assessments, agree to a lower than adequate budget for long-term needs, and actually sort of force a city into this with large properties that maybe are even designed for wealthy people. I mean, this doesn't have, it sounds like the underlying law doesn't have any limits as to the scale of the property, the potential resale value, anything.
Chair Lincheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to be glib. I honestly am trying to think about why this bill even is here. Because I'm thinking it's the fees, which now we've changed the rule on that in the Minnesota House. So I wasn't trying to be glib. I am really puzzled.
Yeah.
And I just want to be honest. I don't have any issue with the reporting at all. In fact, in the era of getting rid of mandates, I think they shouldn't report. I mean, it's just one more report for local units of government to do, and I thought we're trying to go the other way. So I have no problem with it. Not having anyone report to the Department of Revenue on this so it goes in a file. My issue was who can qualify in the first place? Is it the blighting? Is it some level? You know, do you want it to be for condos that are like, there's condos in my city that every unit is almost $1 million? Is it for them too? Or is it, you know, that's what I was talking about. But I don't know that this needs to even be in taxes if the only... Maybe the staff, Baker, or Michael can help us.
Informed it's a special assessment, so it needs, it's a special assessment, so that.
Okay.
Here's what we're going to do, if this is all right, is we'll lay it over as we were going to, see if Representative Pawlowski would like to hear this bill. If it would be included into a division report, there would be much work that would need to be done, and I would promise you that. So it's, that way we can see if it, rather than send it up through taxes here, let's just do it this way. It's being laid over for possible inclusion. We'll talk to Representative Pawlowski to
see if he'd like to hear it. So, is that all right with members, with the idea that we would do more further work? Representative Lanning, would that...
Yeah, that's acceptable as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. So, Representative Mallory removes his motion to lay over House File 204 for possible inclusion into the division report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We don't have to vote. All right, we will go. We are not hearing House File 44, so we are going to move to House File 684. Representative Broad, and then we'll come back to Representative Gardner, if that's all right. He had to leave for a while, so we didn't know if he'd be back in time, so we have Representative Broad to do that. And thank you, Representative Broad. Would someone like to move House File 684? Representative Lanning moves House File 684 for possible inclusion into the division report. We have an amendment. Representative Lanning, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
So moved.
To get that, Representative Lanning moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion of that? If not, we'll vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, members, I appreciate getting the bill into the form in which we are looking to have it. It inadvertently captured one other city, and I would hate to surprise them with some extra money. But, Mr. Chairman and members, last time I was before you with a disaster bill, and this time it's with a perfect storm. What we are looking for is for the city of Green Isle, which is facing some unfortunate circumstances beyond their control, as are many cities. And so don't get me wrong. I understand the challenges are great for cities throughout the entire state. We have some specific situations in the city of Green Isle that I think warrant some additional attention. I would have note for the committee that since 2001, there's been 26 special adjustments for LDA, and so this is not unique. It's unusual, but it's not unique. I think this one warrants it. The city of Green Isle had a significant fire, and this significant fire expended 12.5% of the city's budget to put it out, and in terms of the cost to do this. And so there's that's just one example of the perfect storm that has hit the city of Green Isle. But the foreclosures and the location of the city as well, it's created some significant and unique challenges for this small community. Mr. Chairman and members, I do have here today Mayor Randy Brigger, and he'd like to address the committee. And then I also have Dave Collister, who is the city's financial advisor. And just for the note of the committee, we do have also here today City Council members Chuck White, Steve Gino, and Dale Zumberg. So we brought the heavy hitters from the city of Green Isle. And Mr. Chairman, if I could have the mayor address the committee.
So welcome, Mayor Brecker. If you would please state your name. And
yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Randall Brigger. I'm the mayor of Green Isle. And as you can see, we traveled here approximately 60 miles with most of our council because we felt this was an issue we needed to address. Laura had said here, on July 3rd this past summer, 2008, we had encountered a fire which destroyed approximately 2 square city blocks in the city of Green Isle. Being a small town, myself as well as Mr. Steve Dino, we're on the local fire department as well, and we had a call in aid of 25 different departments, including several major metropolitan area fire departments to put this fire out. Right now, we figure it was probably about 20% of our commercial base that has been destroyed. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Green Isle. Maybe I could give you a little bit of the history. We're located about 60 miles from here. I guess one of the things that we had thought to, we had asked City in Minnesota to have a real working wooden water tower up until 2000 when we were forced to, you know, obviously update. So that's been a big expense as well. But
Mayor Brecker, when was the fire? Or maybe you said,
it was on July 3rd, the day before the 4th of July, this last summer, 2008, at 10 o'clock in the morning. And that lasted for actually about 2 weeks it's molded on.
Wow, okay.
And Mr. Chairman, in the handout, you'll just make note there's all the information related to the fire and the expenditures and all sorts of other things related to the unique situations are on page 2 of the handout that was provided.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Collister, did you want to...
No.
Okay, very good. Mr. Collister.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Dave Callister with Ellers and Associates, and we were hired by the City of Green Isle approximately 6 months ago, and one of the first things we did was to undertake a comprehensive financial management plan, which means a 10-year long-range plan to see what kind of impacts not only the fire but other issues within the city would be on the city's tax rate and what the taxes would be on the city portion, at least for property owners in the City of Green Isle. And so we've done that, and I'd like to share a few things off the report with you. I won't touch on everything, but I'll try to summarize. First of all, as you're well aware, the local government aid formula, bandied about, changes all the time. So the point being that there's no perfect formula, and there are some cities that benefit from changes, benefit from the current LGA law. And in this case, Green Isle, looking at the first comparable chart, which was other cities in Sibley County, their peers, they received about $35,000. That was before the unallotment rate last year. They're scheduled, Green Isle, to get zero in LGA in 2010 under the governor's plan. So I think that's important to realize, as well as the tax rates, which we've also noted on the front page there. Green Isle's 2008 tax rate is 99%. That's gone up to 105% for this year. And I'll share in a minute what that may be projected for in the future. As the mayor indicated, Green Isle has very few commercial properties. 8% of their total tax base is commercial industrial. 92% is ag and residential properties. So there's not a lot of commercial tax base to rely on any type of increase in their expenditures. Couple of other things pointing out here would be the housing market. I know you're well aware of the housing market, but Green Isle did issue some general obligation debt throughout the 2000s, and they had zero housing starts last year and don't expect any this year. They still have to make that those debt payments because some of the developers have not paid their assessments, and along with that, they're not paying their property taxes. They're not having any new water and sewer connection fees or user rates being generated. So revenue-wise, they've taken a big hit with regards to that. The operating reserve, as you know, the state auditor recommends 35 to 50% of fund balance to pay for operations until taxes are received. They currently have a negative fund balance because of the fire and other circumstances, so their cash position is not good. They're relying on other funds to be able to cash flow their general fund. So there's definitely some issues with that. As far as the fire itself, the report indicates about $64,000 worth of expenses that have not been reimbursed because of the fire last year. That had to be paid through the city's general fund. The total, as the mayor said, 20% of the total commercial industrial tax base was burnt in that fire event. We don't know when they received $1,000 for the fire. I just had an insurance settlement, but that's the only money they did receive for that. We realize that, again, the LGA was kind of the funding of last resort. There have been many communities in the past 10 years that have been here to ask for special LGA under unique circumstances, whether they be tornadoes, floods, special circumstances. I've been through a few of those hearings myself, and some of them have just said our LGA isn't the same as our neighboring communities. It's been as simple as that. But we're here today to ask respectfully that the committee consider an LGA increase for the city of Green Isle. And I just wanted to show you some of the impacts that the city is looking at. First of all, they're making further budget cuts as we speak. One of the options is to restructure the debt, but then you're just pushing off things and they have higher interest costs. So that's what they're looking at. Obviously fees, but when you're 92% residential,
the same people are paying just a different way of doing that. And obviously levy increases is what's going to happen if there's no other sources. On page three, I've created a chart as part of the long-range financial planning, and this is not just some numbers that we came up with. We went through a comprehensive process, and I'd be happy to share the spreadsheets with you about looking at every detail of their finances, including taking off the tax base for the fire, which is on for this year, but for page 2010, that tax base, that 3% of the total tax base, is off of the books. The assessor said that the value would be $500, I think, for that property, where it was $268,000. So they came up with, through the planning process, what kind of impact are we going to see in the city of Greenough if nothing, the market doesn't turn around, if they can't recover any expenses for this fire. And you'll see on the page with the blue line, their current tax rate for 2009 is 105%. Now, keep in mind, this is just the city portion of the taxes. This is not school, county, or any special districts. And we are projecting now with the numbers that we know of and the debt schedules that they have, that their tax rate is going to rise in 3 or 4 years to 190%, which is well above average for most communities. And you can kind of see where that that line goes, and a lot of it has to do with the debt for the developers that aren't paying those assessments. Some of it is to repay the costs from the fire because they were borrowed from the general fund and they have to be repaid at some point in time to replenish that. The next page gives you a little bit better idea of what the impact would be. Greenough is by no means a wealthy community. Their average home is around $120,000 range. This particular chart shows what a taxpayer in Greenough would be paying under the 10-year plan for city property taxes. And that looks like it would increase. There's a $125,000 home instead of property. $1,300 for 2009 for city portion. By 2013, they're looking at about $2,400. So quite an extreme increase in property taxes for that home. A lot of homes in Greenough are less than $100,000. In fact, many of the older homes are all less than $100,000. There are some newer homes that bring that up to $125,000 for an average. As we talked about earlier on the last page, it's kind of a history of those municipalities that have been in front of the legislature with LGA requests in the past. And you can see their wide variety of cities. And what I tried to do here was to take a look at, or first of all, give you some historical data with regards to the year and how much LGA they're receiving over and above the existing allocation. And then I put Greenough in there, and then I sorted by 2008 city tax rate, and that's in the middle column, just to give you an idea. And hopefully these cities were able to reduce their city tax rate by getting some additional LGA. And so that hopefully is reflected on some of the bottom half of the page there. But you can see Greenough is at 99 for 2008. They're 105, 130, 170, and so forth. That's where they're headed. And I think you can see that Greenough certainly would fit within the category of many of these requests. And the city is certainly realizes that this is not a great time to be asking for more LGA with the LGA pot shrinking quite a bit. But they also realize that these requests have been met in the past for special circumstances. And the city couldn't plan for a fire. There are other communities that can't plan for disasters. So that is why the city is here today to ask for consideration for additional LGA under these circumstances. And with that, I would entertain any questions that you may have of any of us.
Mr. Kelster, thank you so much. Is there anyone in the audience for or against this bill? And I presume that our council members are up in the front there, so very good. Thank you all for coming down today. Any questions for any of the testifiers? Mr. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, this is a question for House staff. And the city tax rate with the percentages on it, can someone at a high level just explain to me how that number is calculated and what that means?
The city tax rate?
Yeah.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, the tax rates are
Minnesota are percentages, a percentage of tax capacity, and a typical tax capacity, or roughly speaking, in the state is around 100% for all things combined, city, county, school district, et cetera, 100 to 110, somewhere in that range. They vary quite a bit, but typically the total would be around 110%, and you can see Green Isles is getting that high just for the city's share itself. But that is the standard measure. That's the units of a tax rate is percentage of tax capacity.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Roth,
I think I understand it. I hate learning in public. It's so difficult. But so what you're doing is you're taking the assessed value, you're just timesing it by its classification rate to get the tax capacity of the area, and then the amount of money raised divided by that gives you your percentage. Is that correct?
Yeah. Correct. If you, let's say you had $1 million total of tax capacity, added everything up, and you needed $300,000, that would be a 30% tax rate.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the representative. Well, first a question for House Research. I see that the loss of the Samrock property due to the fire was about 3% of your tax base, and I'm thinking that that's not an unusual amount of tax base of loss just due to economic concerns. So that one is a little trickier for me to relate to. And you said that your projections are based on a combination of you've got a lot of special assessments you haven't been able to collect and the fire. Could you give us some more detail about the special assessments you haven't been able to collect?
And this will be the final question because we've got one more bill to do. So, Mr. Callister.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the major one is there. I don't know how many lots there are, but there was a new subdivisions that were done in 2000, starting in 2000, and just last fall the developer has walked away from paying those assessments, and that is a good share of the spike in what you're seeing in those graphs. The actual fire part of it is more of a cash flow where they're in a negative cash flow position, so as we're encouraging them to start budgeting because you can't run on a negative forever because you're going to, the general fund has to be able to support itself. So part of that increase is also to replenish that general fund to acceptable standards so that they can operate from January until their first tax payment in July so they don't have to borrow short term, which is certainly something that we would not recommend. So I think it's a combination. I would say a large share of it is because of empty lots where a developer has walked away from it and there's general obligation debt that has to be paid. And some of that debt can be restructured, some of it can't.
Thank you. Representative Broad, any last comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just in response to the 3%, it's the 3% is of the total tax base, 20% of the commercial tax base, and certainly those are both big numbers when you have a commercial tax base as small as the city of Green Isle actually does have. And so, Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much for the time of the committee and appreciate working with you as this goes forward.
Thank you very much. And just one clarification on the bill summary. It says the aids are payable in 2010 only. It's for permanent funding. So just that clarification. Representative Lanning renews his motion to lay over House File 684 for possible inclusion in the division report.
As amended.
Thank you. As amended. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming up today. Quickly, we're going to do minutes. While we have members here, do I hear a motion to approve the February 18th minutes?
So
moved. Representative Dietrich moves the February 18th minutes of 2009. Any comments? If not, we have a motion to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. Before we go on the last bill, also a couple of announcements on the working group. All three bills, ones that Representative Lanning has worked on, Representative Dietrich and myself, will all be heard in local government division March 9th. So I know some of you I think that meeting starts at 4:30, and Chair Nelson has said if it needs to go to midnight, he will that night with those three bills. And then they will be heard in the full Committee of Government and Local Ops on March 11th, and that meeting would start at 8:30.
So that's the schedule right now. They might have other visits before they come back, the property tax division. But we'll give a little further report when that happens, but I think the bills have been shaping up in very fine fashion. I really, really appreciate the work of the chairs and staff and all those involved who have worked on those working groups. I think we have some very strong bills that are going to create some reform and accountability and some flexibility, and I think we're on our way. So, anything else I need to do for housekeeping? All right, well then. Okay. All right, we now have House File 663. Representative Gardner, do we have a motion to lay that over? Representative Loeffler moves to lay over House File 663 for possible inclusion. Representative Gardner, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My part will be quick anyway. House File 663 is something that many of you have probably seen before. I'm sure every time truth and taxation notices come out, people say, why does this come out after the general election? And I guess I didn't know the answer, and I spoke to the chair during the interim, and they said, well, why don't you bring it forward? And I did, and I realized we may be putting a square hole through a round peg through a square hole. You know, every 2 years will we bring this forward, but I'm hoping by bringing it forward we can figure out some solution for increasing transparency when it comes to truth and taxation as people look at some of the choices in November. And I think it actually would add some more transparency at the local level, but also at the state level, because many of the decisions about how your property tax goes come from the state level. So, Mr. Chair, since this is something you've seen before, I won't go on other than to say that it wasn't quite as simple as I thought. You do have to move up several other dates. Obviously, the notices would go out for truth and taxation between October 15th and October 24th, but that would move up several other dates, including the decisions for school district certification of levies by 15 days, and moving up the requirement for the budgets for other types of local jurisdictions by about 30 days. And the public hearings would be moved up by about 3 weeks, but that would actually come after the general election. Mr. Chair, that's it. I look forward to any thoughtful deliberation. I know you're short on time, but I think there may be some folks who would talk about the logistics.
Representative Gardner, there's an old saying, if you ever really want to learn about something, try to change it. And you can learn about the whole system. But this has actually been in a couple House bills before. Actually, when Representative Abrams was the tax chair, it made it through the House but never survived conference committee. So it's actually been in there a few times, yeah. So so I think everyone kind of understands, for new members, it's just moving the truth and taxation meeting notice from mid-November to mid-October. So why don't we take testimony on this, right? Because I don't want to miss that. So I know there is testimony that Representative Gardner has some experience. So if those opposed, I mean testifiers, would come forward, please do so. Mr. Nord, you're first.
And Mr. Chair, it's, I hadn't really heard from anybody, and then as soon as I walked in the door this afternoon, I was the most popular guy in the room.
You do get a lot of friends with
us. I love that name.
Yes. Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jason Nord from the Department of Revenue, and just wanted to share some of the concerns that we have possibly in conjunction with county auditors. So the workability of this bill, more so than the idea of the bill, the September 15th date for certification of school district levies is extremely problematic. The date actually at one point in time had been September 15th, and it got pushed back to September 30th. And the September 30th date is already pretty difficult for the Department of Education to meet. And every year we do run into corrections and errors, even using the September 30th date. So moving that up 2 weeks, and I think, I'm not sure if the Department of Education is here to testify as well, but I know they've testified in the past that date just does not work for them to move it up that early. Or at least if you do move it up that early, you're dramatically increasing the risk for errors. Then also the October 15th to October 24th time frame for sending out notices, I would say would range range between extraordinarily difficult for counties to accomplish possibly impossible for the counties to accomplish. A county like Hennepin that has to send out an extraordinary number
of P&T notices needs 2 or 3 weeks just to print and mail the notices, and so they need more than a week to prepare all those notices and do all the calculations and the sharing of levy information. So if it is possible, it would definitely risk a lot of errors. And it's also important to note that the people who would be producing these statements are also the same people who are running the elections. So to have them right before the election being fully consumed with P&T notices certainly poses problems for both processes. There's also a few different drafting issues with the bill. The new dates in sections 2 and 3 are impossible because they actually precede the September 15th date for school districts to certify the levies. So you can't share rates before you've actually adopted a levy. And then the hearing dates in some of the later sections are not congruent because the second Thursday or the second Tuesday or the second Wednesday of the month could actually fall on November 8th, which could be election day, but it also falls before the November 9th to December 1st window that the bill sets up. So it's certainly a very scary thought for those of us who administer the system to see if we could actually pull this off into the level of errors that would occur if we did try to pull off moving up the truth and taxation process. So,
and Mr. Nord, I heard you say between extraordinarily difficult to impossible. Is that between slim and none?
I think that
parallel to slim and none?
I think that that would be fair as well to characterize it in that slow term.
Thank you very much. Anyone else from the audience would care to speak against this bill? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Keith Carlson, Minnesota Intercounty Association, testifying on behalf of the counties and county auditors. I just want to reinforce Mr. Nord's comments. I would err on the side of none has the chance that this could possibly be put into effect. Not only do you move up the dates by picking out the notice by 1 month, you also compress the schedule that we have to do it by 14 days. And it is a very difficult effort right now to meet the current schedule that is 14 days longer. And I will finally remind you, in addition to all the issues that Mr. Nord raised, you've done nothing on the front end of the process that is the state's responsibilities in the complete levy certification process. You have not changed the date for when local government aid or county program aid is certified to the counties. You have not changed the date on which fiscal disparities, various levy certifications occur for purposes of that, and that's a necessary component for completing the truth and taxation notices. And finally, you haven't moved up the date of levy limit certification. I congratulate the department. I think they have exceeded their legal duty by meeting this date, but right now the statutory date for levy limit certification to the cities and counties is September 1st, exactly the date that you have in this legislation for the local government to then turn around and certify its levy. You can't do one before you have the other.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative, anyone else care to speak against the bill? Thank you. Anyone else going to speak for or against the bill? This is our last. Okay, you got, and I'll give you about 1 minute.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make it a quick and simple. Grace Kelleher, I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I want to follow up Mr. Carlson's comments and let you know that there really are huge problems for school districts. School this year, because of the late Labor Day start, doesn't start to the 7th, and on the 8th, the department is supposed to have our information to start the levy certification process. And the number of kids in school really matters a lot in how we figure our revenue, and that's really problematic. Certainly changing when school starts and allowing us to start before Labor Day might provide that information earlier. But, and I'll go on the record, but it'd be really tough. Thank you,
very
Mr.
Good.
Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the members? Otherwise, I'm going to Representative Gardner for closing comments.
Mr. Chair, I just offer this for your thoughtful consideration. I am hoping, though, that over time, that maybe with the use of technology also, we can figure out some other tools for quicker transmission of information for taxpayers if they're interested. Maybe Representative Garofalo can help me, you know, maybe set up a Twitter site for county auditors where we can send out your stuff. This would be a fiscal note on that one, I'm sure. But
Gardner, I don't know.
That was it.
This is any indication of your bill, but the person who made the initial motion is gone. But you don't have to be here, but we are, Representative Loeffler did move to lay over a House file, what's the number here? 663 for possible inclusion in the division report. And anything else from members? We will do that. We will lay that over, so thank you, Representative Gardner, for your courage in bringing this forward this year. Members? Thank you very much.